We did not talk about the three measures not picked by staff, but I think we can probably move past them. So under the bipolar category.
Can I just flag one thing? So the only thing that jumps out at me in the depression section is that I really like both of the first two, 4.1, 4.2, but they don't work at the health plan level, it seems like. So I think that that is just something that I'm not sure we would want to not have some kind of measure that is broadly addressing screening or broadly addressing treatment that doesn't apply at the health plan level.
Okay, our next topic, we have two measures available that look at bipolar and depression diagnoses together. We have one staff pick that people identified with these conditions have appraisal for alcohol or substance use. You know, we know of the comorbidity, so this is a screening in use in two other federal programs. This is NQF number 110. Is it a silence, a lack of support, or a lack of disagreement? So I'm not quite sure. Everyone's reading. It's a process measure. It is applied at the clinician practice level. Can be ambulatory care or behavioral health outpatient. Juliana?
I would just say that this is another one, since it's depression or bipolar in the numerator, that it should be expanded to other populations as well.
Sarah, I was just trying to look back to see if it was sufficiently different from the alcohol engagement and other drug dependence treatment measure. That would you need them both?
Might have to get back to you on that.
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead and really loud. Sorry, everybody, this phone is not working very well. Is there a measure that is more cross-cutting for a number of mental illness conditions rather than simply how to? A serious mental illness screener question?
Yeah, I think Valerie was just raising a similar point. So this is, somewhat narrow to these diagnosis groups, and we can look at that. We've already been through, the alcohol and substance and tobacco use measures, so if you didn't see something there, one of them might fit the bill as being broad enough, but it's hard to figure that out on the fly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Seeing as the topic we just did is depression and bipolar is next, so is this really trying to drive at the interaction between the two? I mean, that's what I'm trying to sort of wrap my brain around, what we're trying to do by combining them.
I thought this had to do with appraisal for alcohol or substance use for bipolar and or depression. And there is a particular interaction there about alcohol and substance use, particularly with bipolar. the data are pretty strong about what about that interaction. So I thought that's what this measure was about.
Right. So for example, if there's a really strong interaction with bipolar, and there's a section that is bipolar measures, that's why I was asking
Okay.
If there was something detailed that I was missing.
Right. No, I understand.
We pulled it out because the denominator includes people with bipolar and depression, but if you think about the topic orientation, it's not about the treatment of either one of those conditions. It's about the co-occurring substance use. So it might have been better to consider previously with the other screening measures, but just because it was a narrow denominator population, it sort of sorted itself out separately. I'm not hearing a lot of support for moving this one forward. We'll look for a more broad measure. Deb?
It seems like this measure is trying to get at the issue of, among the seriously mentally ill, have you screened for alcohol and substance abuse? And the way it is right now, there isn't quite a measure for that, unless you were to take the screening for alcohol measure and reported on the subpopulation of seriously mentally ill or alcohol. I mean, that's another way to do it that would be more parsimonious.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think we should move ahead.
Okay. Under the bipolar category, topic number 6, there are 4 available measures and 2 highlighted by staff. Again, this issue of suicide risk is coming up, just specific to the bipolar population, in NQF number 111. We know that 3 in 10 people with bipolar attempt suicide. And so on that basis alone, it seemed to be very important. Second measure, number 112, has to do with evaluating the level of a person's functioning. So this is at an initial assessment and 12 weeks after initiating treatment. So it's a little bit process-oriented still, but it is getting at the effectiveness of the intervention related to their ultimate health outcomes. The measures not picked by staff in this category all relate to different types of medication management for the bipolar condition. And for that reason, we thought they were a little bit too narrow to include in a broader set. That you could establish you could infer some type of good medication use by having a level of function evaluation.
Sarah, I have a measurement gap area. This is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
So for bipolar disorder, I agree that measuring lithium, for instance, would be too narrow. But in this population, a lot of SMI populations, the medications themselves have an impact on overall health. And if you don't do screening, they're at risk for other complications. So, for instance, liver problems for folks that are on the field. And so I didn't know if there were questions that would be relevant for the overall SMI population about the health screenings in general.
Yeah, some of the chronic disease screening we'll consider tomorrow morning.
Okay.
I don't quite understand why level of function evaluation is applied exclusively to bipolar. It doesn't make any sense to me on the face of it. And not to schizophrenia and depression and substance use and anything else we're talking about. Cognitive impairment.
Yeah, I don't know the intention of the developer there. We can make a recommendation that it could be expanded. Yeah, it's not a developer that I'm familiar with.
We're discussing 112. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it, you know, it focuses on functional impairment activities of daily living, does not focus on independent living skills, the ability to live in the community. So I think it's, there's Mady's question, why it applies to bipolar, but then it's a very limited assessment of the ability to live in the community independently. And to go back to Sean's point in self-direct, the ability to self-direct.
Is it too limited to be useful?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We will not include it. All right. We have one staff tick under schizophrenia related to adherence to antipsychotic medications. It's number 1879. Medication adherence was identified as a key issue. This is aligned and in use in the Medicaid adult core set, and it's in a private program as well. It does exclude people with dementia. The process measure, it applies to individuals 18 and older. Calculated at the clinician practice level, the health plan, or the state. And it can be drawn from claims or pharmacy data.
Someone else previously made the point about all of the side effects of these medications. Obesity wasn't mentioned. So I'm uncomfortable with, did the person take the med, yes or no, and that's the measure. That's important. But what happens because of the medication, both positively and negatively, are more important. So that's a concern I have.
Not even precisely did they take the med. It's, did they fill the prescription? So it's like, do you have on hand in your house enough to cover 80% of the days that you should have pills in your house? But it's not, did you swallow it?
So we have two state Medicaid programs that limit the number of medications to 3 or 5 per month per person. So a person may want to take the 6th medication, but the system won't allow it, and yet we're going to measure somebody and say, you know, you didn't do your job, you didn't allow this person to fill theirs, and it's a failure of the system. I think this is a much more complex area than whether you filled your prescription or take them in. Jim?
Yeah, just on that point, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I do know that about half of schizophrenics have anosognosia. They don't believe they have a disease to begin with. So half of the schizophrenic population doesn't believe they need to take a medicine. I'm not sure how you control for that, because the best you're going to get is 50% compliance most of the time. So does anybody in that field have an idea of how one actually addresses or measures whether somebody actually accepts that they have the disease for which people are giving them the medicine?
SAMHSA does have recommendations on advanced psychiatric directives, and we have something like 42 of the 50 states that have state laws, and that's so when you're not experiencing your schizophrenia, you can, in advance, say what seems to work for me and what seems not to work for me. It's not a measure, but it's a partial response to your question, is trying to get at, so if I gained 130 pounds the last time I was on this medicine, I probably don't want to be on it again, even though it might subside my symptoms of schizophrenia at the moment. And so, again, this is a complex one.
Valerie, did you have a comment?
If this is the right time to bring it up, but because it's actually the other question, not about whether they took the drugs, but apparently with the SPMI population, they take a lot of atypical antipsychotic drugs that have a lot of side effects. And so there are a number of drugs that might be considered high-risk medications that are antidotes, so to speak, to the side effects that the SPMI people have to take in order to counter the side effects. And so what my member was telling me is they get marked down for giving too many of those high-risk drugs, even though they need it to offset the atypical antipsychotic drugs. So that should show up here somewhere, it seems to me.
Need a broader measure, maybe. Leonardo?
Yeah, this is a general comment that may apply to this medication and may apply to some others, which is something we deal with when we're trying to analyze Medicaid quality measures that are time-based, right, 12-month period. So your denominator is starting with people who are continually in the group for 12 months, which tends to be selective, right? So if it's, if you're measuring something in a health plan and the measure is for people who have been in the health plan 9 months, you know, did they get X? By starting with for people who have been in the health plan 9 months in the Medicaid context, that already may tell you a lot about who the population is. So that's just something that, and I have some colleagues I've done who know more about this and can give specific examples of where this has caused some problems. So I'll try and get those and bring them back to the group. But I think that is something we should be thinking about because it may be that the person who was in the system for 9 months is actually the one who has less problems. Mm-hmm. And it may give you a sense of fairly high treatment success when, in fact, you have people that are coming on and off.
Sean?
Yeah, first I agree with everything Clark said, and then also on your question around this whole anapsychnosis, it seems that's more of a metaphor. I mean, it's not really, and in any case, there are, as I think you mentioned, Clark, as most states have outpatient commitment laws, so if there's any danger of self or others, then that's been documented, courts get involved, and then essentially what assertive community treatment has evolved to in many cases is a way for people to adhere to whatever is decided legally on that question. So that makes it more complex because you now you have legal systems involved, you have treatment providers who are assertive community treatment, you're going out to the person's house, you are essentially in many cases, in this situation, making sure they're taking meds because that's what the court said you have to do. And so now you have a whole bunch of things involved in this. And if you're not in any of those sort of situations, you can decide what you want to do. And then there's levels of coercion that go from subtle to, isn't it a good idea to take meds, you're going to feel better. Yeah, it's a good weight gain, we'll work on that, to court ordered, everything in between. And but there's also this newer model of shared decision making. I just want to put that out there as another thing to really start to look at, that it's about the person's quality of life in the context of their whole life, not just whether they're taking meds or not. And that's really becoming the important thing to look at. And I wonder if Santa has done much on, with Lisa were here, on any quality measures around that, but that would be good to look at.
This is Anna. I have one other thing to add to that. I agree with what you were saying, and I also wonder if there's any kind of social determinant questions or anything related to housing. Obviously, homelessness is a higher risk in population, but, any sort of documentation of other social services.
This is how we're going to spend our waking hours this evening, is trolling for some of these other topics. So we'll hopefully, if we can trace any of them back, we'll bring them tomorrow. Maybe if you're not speaking in support of this measure, we're going to move on. Oh, you can ask a question.
And ask whether we have any data on churning in Medicaid for this dual eligible population.
We'll give that assignment to Cheryl.
do this. Yeah. At our very first meeting in 2011, we had presented a bit of a paper that showed there's relatively less churn among duals than in Medicaid generally. You have people continuously coming in and out, but that's, I think, more due to death, to be perfectly frank.
Okie dokie, we're going to move on to cardiometabolic monitoring.
Okay, so this is following right on the heels of all those comments about side effects. We have 8 measures about cardiometabolic monitoring and 2 selected by staff as fairly strong. The first is NQF number 1927. It's a cardiovascular health screening for people with schizophrenia or bipolar who are on antipsychotics. So this is a key issue, as we've just discussed, for people with these conditions. This measure applies to health plans, integrated delivery systems, or state levels of analyses, and it can be used in ambulatory care or actually skilled nursing facility care settings, I think possibly other institutions as well. NQF number 1932 is diabetes screening for people with schizophrenia or bipolar who are prescribed antipsychotics. Same key issue about new or worsening health conditions. This measure applies to health plans or states and ambulatory care or skilled nursing as well. Measure 1932 has also been picked up by the Illinois state demonstration for dual eligibles.
Deb? The recent NCQA endorsed measures in this group, the 1932, I think there's like 4 of them. They move them all into HEDIS in January.
Lady? Is there a reason why these are so narrow? Cardiometabolic screening for people with substance use disorders is equally applicable. There's enough data and clinical trials on that. And diabetes screening as well. So I'm sort of, I don't get it.
Because of the side effects of the medicines, right? That's why it's of particular interest.
It's also the disparities in terms of things like death rate with respect to the population, and so to try and get some of the health issues among the seriously mentally ill is kind of what drove the development of these measures, things that community mental health centers maybe should be paying attention to and coordinating with primary care.
I want to reinforce all these measures and Deb's point. National Association of State Mental Health Directors did a study in like 2005. People with serious and persistent mental illness die 25 years earlier on average than the rest of us. They don't die of mental illness. They die of heart attack and diabetes, et cetera. So SAMHSA has a wellness campaign, and to give you the complexity of the issue, the wellness campaign was initially the 10-by-10 campaign, cut that gap of 25 years by 10 years and 10 years. They dropped the 10-by-10 because that was too ambitious. But this is a very serious issue. The mental health system neglects chronic conditions and health conditions of people with serious mental illness. They just treat the mental illness, and then people die. And so these measures are fundamentally important.
Thanks. Valerie.
Yeah, California.
Hold on, please.
Sorry. California just started requiring health plans under the Medi-Cal program to start reporting 2 measures for SPMI, diabetes screening for people with schizophrenia or bipolar who are using antipsychotic meds, and cardiovascular monitoring for people with cardiovascular disease and schizophrenia.
Sean?
In addition to what everybody else said, including Clark, I agree. I think it's really important to do this, and that also because you're collecting this at the administrative level, it, you know, part of the maybe recommendation might be to look at some of the social determinants like food deserts, stuff like that. I mean, you know, your people generally who are in these situations aren't living in and can afford to go to Whole Foods, you know, and understand all that. So, you know, this is, I think, important. So just as a way of, I don't know when you roll these out, if there are, you know, if there's some narrative around utility and how to approach different populations with these measures, might be helpful.
Leonardo.
Just a question of clarification, and Clark might be the person to ask. If we take the pie chart for FMI, what percentage are people who are either schizophrenia or bipolar? In other words, if you're targeting a measure towards those two groups, what percentage of people out there are you getting?
Mady probably has it off the top of her head. I will say the World Health Organization says schizophrenia is one of the most devastating illnesses in the world in terms of both death and impact. But
it's a considerably small percentage. It's not more than 3%.
Right. So,
but maybe with bipolar we come up to 5%. But nevertheless.
Yeah, I'm not diminishing the importance of those groups. What I'm wondering is, can that denominator be expanded to bring in some other groups? Because it seems to me that it seems to me if the problem is happening in those two areas, it's probably happening in other areas. And I don't think of SMI as being just those two populations.
Right.
Neither do I.
If you did the census of state psychiatric hospitals, schizophrenia, I'm just guessing, is probably 60% or 70% of the inpatient population.
Right.
So
that's correct.
You're talking about the severity and the impact versus the overall prevalence.
Yeah.
Thanks. George?
Yeah, I would agree with the comments, and certainly the comments that Leonardo just made about the denominator, because looking at the exclusions, you know, having had a myocardial infarction or having coronary bypass, et cetera, that in itself should be more of a reason that you should be included so that you can have your LDL screen, et cetera. So it seems to fight the purpose of and the objective of what this measure was set to be for.
Sarah, pick up a statistic here before we go ahead.
27% of dual eligible beneficiaries have a diagnosis of depression, 6% have a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and we don't know bipolar, but it's at least 4% in the general population, and we can assume it's higher. So you're over 10%.
Just one thing, excuse me, one thing actually working in the San Diego jail is an enormous number of these patients who are screened in the jail, and yet the information is not available to the patients when they leave. So there's a gap in terms of being able to identify screening that may be going on in one setting that other people really don't have. There may actually be duplicity, to tell you the truth, because a lot of these people are cycling in and out, and I'm always seeing patients getting their liver function tests and their cholesterols and things measured by the psychiatrist, and then I'm certain that information never gets out to the community when they finally leave, but they'll come right back again and we'll get it done again.
Maybe, do you have another comment, or are you? Okay. All right, I'm feeling a lot of consensus around keeping these two in, nodding around the table. Yes, okay, we're going to keep these two in the list. Thank you very much, and now we're going to move on to SMI screening where we have no staff picks.
I can tell you why. There are two measures here. Both have been either submitted to the current endorsement project or reopened as a part of the endorsement project. So we didn't feel as if we had quite enough information to go on to recommend that these move forward. But for the sake of bringing them to the group for discussion, the first is the title Severity Adjusted Effect Size Measure for Adult Behavioral Health Symptoms and Functioning. This measures the change in behavioral health symptoms among adult patients who are receiving outpatient behavioral health services. It is quite a complex measure from the look of specifications, but it does use patient-reported data in the form of a survey to be calculated. It applies at the clinician individual or practice level. The other measure is called the M3 checklist, and this is a patient-completed screen of 27 questions that detects bipolar disorder, depression, PTSD, and GAD. This is calculated at a facility level.
So neither one of them are really in widespread use, it doesn't look like, and unless there's a strong feeling about these, or if you have a direction about where else to look for similar kinds of measures, we'll just record this as a gap.
Alice, just for our health plan colleagues around the table, this is a measure by Optimum Healthcare, a managed care plan, and Rhonda Ronson-Beal, a member of this group, is chief medical officer of Optimum, and so it can be done. It is very limited, but it can be done in a health plan arena.
Thank you. Okay. Okay to move ahead to the echo survey. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. We have two more topics under this population group, and we're coming up on lunch, so thank you all for your patience so far. This topic is the experience of individuals as receiving behavioral health treatment services. And the staff has picked out one of two available measures. It's number 0008, the Experience of Care and Health Outcomes Survey, also known as the ECHO. This has been highlighted by this group in the past as a CAPS-like measure. It's currently in the MAPS Care Coordination family of measures. It's a health plan level measure. Sensitive to disparities in care, it's a patient-reported outcome, and relates to high-impact conditions in the behavioral health area. It's also been picked up by the California, Illinois, Massachusetts, and Ohio state demonstrations.
Now, last time I looked, ARC was still the measure steward for this because it was in the CAPS family.
This one has been really embraced by the duals demos, I think, in terms of having, you know, any really good experience of care kind of survey that gets to this subpopulation.
Can I ask what may be a dumb question? When it says level analysis health plan, what's the outer limit on that? So, for example, if it's a managed fee-for-service system, if it's a health home system, if it's an ACO system, what is and is not in health plan?
In terms of being able to use the survey as a CAPS tool,
It was developed for health plans before they were less complicated than health plans are now.
Thanks. I just think that, you know, one of the things that HHS is doing is testing new models of care. And if we had a measure that was really good in, say, your standard capitated HMO model, but couldn't be used in a managed fee-for-service model or an ACO model, you know, that would really limit your ability to assess. You might come to the conclusion that a managed care organization is doing a pretty good job because their percentage is 92, and in fact, you know, an ACO would be doing 96, or you conversely might think they were doing a really bad job because they were at 62% when in fact all the other models wouldn't get above 40. So I just think it
it would be important for HHS to have that down the road, I would think.
Alice?
Thanks. Yeah.
This is where I'd like to request a footnote. In the interim report we sent to CMS in December, we did discuss the four states that finance independent consumer and family assessment teams. So it's not only what you're measuring, it's who's doing the measurement. And Massachusetts, Maryland, parts of Wisconsin, and parts of Pennsylvania require this. Massachusetts, for a decade, Medicaid managed care has required the health plans to finance independent consumer-run and family-run assessment teams. And they don't focus on the 92 or 96%. They focus on the 4% or the 8%. And they say, you know, who's the 4%? Who's the 8%? What's wrong? What's not working? Rather than bragging about the 92%, what's not working on the 8%? And so it's not a measurement issue per se, but I keep repeating it because it's an important consumer dynamic. It's who does it, peers do it, trained peers do it, and just if we could have a footnote there, and you could just pick the same language you used in the interim report, so it's all done, it's just repeating it.
Okay, any objections? Anybody feel strongly about not supporting the ECHO tool? No? Good? Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Wouldn't be in addition to the CAHPS measures that plans already report on a variety of health plan experience, like, you know, overall rating of health plan, you know, experience, you know, there's a whole bunch of administrative metrics that plans have to report that deal with how well the plan serves them and the provider network that's attached to the plan. So we're not just adding one more, right?
I was going to say, I don't remember that ECHO.
This is trying to get at the issues of what was your behavioral health care like,
okay.
The relationship between the provider and between those kinds of issues rather than what did the plan do.
But the CAHPS measures ask questions about your experience with the provider that the plans have to report on.
There's like only one or two questions, and this is designed specifically for a broader kind of set of questions for people who receive behavioral health care.
So a plan that served only people with behavioral health maybe could substitute these and not report on the series of other ones so that they wouldn't have to be duplicating. Personally.
There is a set of CAHPS plan questions. I mean, there's supplemental questions. What I don't know off the top of my head is, are the ECHO questions in the list of the supplemental plan questions, which is sort of what HEDIS does when it goes out? That level of detail, I don't know.
Okay.
I suspect that you probably want to take the two and put them together and get three quarters of them, but I don't know if there's a methodology to do that, and that's really just off the top of my head.
Sure.
But if you were to do just the ECHO, you're just going to find out about their experience with the provision of the behavioral health care. It's not going to tell you if the plan answered your questions or, you know, if they had access problems or any other kind of stuff.
Right. And the person with mental health issues isn't only getting mental health services. They're getting a variety of other services.
Right. Whereas this is just focused on mental health. Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have a comment, Laura?
Deb said it very well. And they technically could get two surveys. I mean, they could get a CAHPS survey to assess their experience with the health plan, and then if they've had behavioral health services within the health plan, and a lot of times those are administered by like an MBHO or something, they would get that survey too. So it is two different surveys, really.
Okay.
They're both sample.
Right. Sean.
Another kind of sort of in the context question, a point. So by the time people get in to, you know, Medicaid and go through the process, and by the way, many for psychiatric disabilities, often there's forced hospitalizations, there's a lot of, often there's interaction with the law, et cetera. And so there's a fundamental question about, okay, so now I finally got this, I got my SSI, I finally got some stability perhaps. You know, any question that looks at satisfaction has got to look at satisfaction compared to what, you know. And the what in many cases is really awful, the other side. But if there was a better sense, so there's an educational piece to this. Like, what else could there be? You know, what other kinds of things are out there that are not on the table for me? Because look what it took me just to get this. And I think that there's a piece, and I don't know, I haven't seen the survey, so I haven't looked online, but in general, surveys, these kinds of surveys don't get at those kinds of questions, and that again is a sort of a disparity or another piece to figure out a way to take a look at, to really get at whether people are truly satisfied or they're just like, okay, I got something.
So, but most of the CAHPS surveys are designed to ask experience of care questions.
The CAHPS surveys aren't designed to measure satisfaction. They're designed to measure your experience with your care process. Satisfaction is an objective articulation that could change over time, even though the delivery of care didn't change over time. And so the experience surveys are trying to get at the delivery of care. Now, the question you're asking is, are the outcomes or the quality of life for the person met, which I agree is an important question, but it's just not captured in the CAHPS experience tools.
You've just explained why four states, finance, independent, consumer, and family monitoring teams, to have a peer, trained peer and trained family member engage you and ask you those kinds of questions. And it's a different paradigm than this whole National Quality Forum stuff, but it's a supplement. It's a very important supplement to get to those questions.
All right, we're getting down to the last 12 minutes.
Well, I wanted to comment that with regard to perception of care, that in fact, the published literature suggests that if you ask questions about satisfaction, it does not correlate with anything with regard to addiction treatment. And what you have to ask to get any kind of correlations about what's happening to a patient in an addiction treatment program is ask about dissatisfaction and perceptions. So the fact that this is perceptions of care is very important.
Leonardo, do you have a...
Just the obvious point that it's 10.1, is, you know, I'm very supportive of. 10.2 gets to facilities, whereas 10.1 doesn't. So I don't know if that means you would want to have them both in the family so that you could address both of those things, or if that needs to be a gap. But I'm supportive of 10.1. I just wanted to point that out.
Do others agree about including the second measure of behavioral health experience as well?
I wasn't necessarily putting out a motion to do that. I was just putting it out because it might be a gap. It might be that people feel that it should be added. I don't know if we want two measures in this area. It's just...
Any thoughts on that?
I'm in support of the concept of an inpatient measure. The one thing that I would say is protection and advocacy, which is federally mandated to monitor nursing homes and mental health institutions, may have some interesting measures in this area. So if we do decide to go down that road, you might kind of look at what they use.
Okay, Deb?
I have heard some people, and I will not quote, have some particular issues with this particular measure. That's one statement. Number two statement is this measure is currently being proposed under the inpatient psychiatric facility program for Medicare in the current rule that's out for comment right now. It's being proposed as a structure measure. Does the
IPF collect this instrument or not. So.
So I don't know if we really actually have consensus on this one then.
I don't think it's quite ready for prime time.
Does anybody want to? Does anybody want to like strongly support the Echo survey being on our list? No, no.
The Echo? Wait, sorry.
Does anybody in this group strongly support including the Echo? Yes. Oh, you were saying about the second one. Sorry. Got it. Okay. No, I'm with you. No, I'm with you now. I'm caught up. The Echo, yes, and the second one, no. Right? Okay. We're heading to the home stretch, inpatient psych.
Okay. This is grouped as a setting a little bit differently than a number of the other measures we've looked at this morning, simply because they are, you know, fairly narrow, yet a very important set of services. So they kind of come in a big set. You'll recognize the acronym HBIPS from our previous work. The staff has picked 4 out of 7 available inpatient psychiatric facility measures, and in no particular order. The first is number 557, which is HBIPS 6, that there's a post-discharge continuing care plan created, and then the following measure, that care plan is transmitted to the next level of care when the person is discharged. Both of these measures have been in our core set for some time. They're also part of the MAP care coordination family of measures. Transitions have always been an important issue for discussion in this group, and these measures are in use in the inpatient psychiatric hospital quality reporting program, so they're already collected. The two measures I just mentioned are designed to be used together as paired measures. In addition, measure 640, which is HBIPS 2, relates to the hours of physical restraint use. This is a key issue that came up during our web meeting discussion. And HBIPS 3 relates to the hours of seclusion use. That's NQF number 641. Similarly, a key issue that people raised, they want to see very minimal use of physical restraints and seclusions within inpatient psych. Both of these measures can be extracted from paper records or electronic medical records, and again are in the inpatient psych program already in place.
Alrighty, so in this group, we're going to ask for anybody who wants to speak strongly in favor of any of these four. If you have a strong, positive, yes, important to include, this is the time to speak up. Of these four staff picks in patient psych. Clark.
I wanted to speak to the importance of a restraint and seclusion measure, and this is really a watered-down compromise from the legislation that NAMI and others worked on in 2000 to pass, which would have required a physician within an hour to affirm the clinical necessity of a restraint and seclusion. That was the law, that was the regulation, and then over the decade, that got watered down to this. So this is like the minimum thing that we have now, is at least you count how many hours somebody is in seclusion and restraint, and if there's an outlier, you do something about it. So I support it as the bare minimum safety check on the restraint and seclusion issue.
Thanks. Deb, do you have your card up for a reason or not really? Okay. All right.
I will add that of the Medicare beneficiaries that use an IPF, 57% are girls.
anybody want to say anything about either of the other two measures? Important to include? Not? Mm-mm. Maybe?
I think that's too narrow. That's all I'll say. Ones that have to do with discharge and post-discharge continuing care plans created, I think that should apply across the board, and this is inpatient psych, and I don't think that's particularly useful or helpful.
Look for consensus on the physical restraint and hours of seclusion.
I'm supportive.
All right, good. We'll keep those in the family. And that's it for, 4 minutes before noon. I think we should. I think let's hold off on the next one until after lunch. But let's pause here and have a public comment. If there's anybody in the room.
We have a microphone.
Yeah, we have a microphone. So if folks in the room can come up. And while we're doing that, operator, could you instruct people on the phone how to comment if they would like to at this point?
To ask a question or make a comment, please press star 1. There are no questions or comments.
Okay, thanks, operator. Tom, yeah. Go ahead.
Tom James, former colleague of your in this group, now with AmeriHealth Caritas. The discussion today has been very interesting, and I think it really points to the fact that we are all struggling with issues which are important to individuals and to populations for single events, single points of quality. The concern that I've got is that what we, and it's too late now to make any recommendations to the Secretary for this round, but that for the future we should consider the development of measures of systemness. Massachusetts has been there. Northwestern University has a whole program on systemness in healthcare. Kaiser had a wonderful symposium that delineated the elements that could be used in measurements of systemness. That would encompass the entire person and encompass the entire population. So while I don't advocate doing anything about it now, because lunch is pending, that it'd be considered for our next round of measures. And that may take care of some of these issues today.
Thank you. Any other... Okay. One more public comment.
I'll be extremely brief. I'm Andrew Sperling with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I just want to congratulate this group and National Quality Forum for the work they've done. This is extremely important to people with mental illness. There's a lot of anxiety about what's happening in the states that have MOUs for people with serious mental illness who will be enrolled in new dual-eligible plans. And I agree with many of the comments made today. One of the biggest issues for us as an organization of people with mental illness and their family members is the early mortality experienced by people with mental illness, and I was intrigued by the discussion today about the screening that's going to be done on cardiovascular and metabolic, all of these other conditions that one statistic was cited has actually been somewhat discredited as the lower life expectancy, but we do know the NIMH estimates that people living in the U.S. living with serious mental illness have a life expectancy just below adults in Bangladesh. This is a public health crisis that needs to be addressed, and no population experiences this more than dual eligibles living with serious mental illness, particularly schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which SAMHSA calculates as, or NIMH uses as the proxy for severe and persistent mental illness. So thank you for all your work on this, and these measures are extremely important.
Thank you for coming, and thank you for speaking up. Anybody else? Operator, going once, going twice on the phone. Did anybody pipe up and want to comment on the phone lines?
No, there are no questions or comments.
Thank you. So we are going to have a lunch break. Sarah, do you want to give instructions? Can we start at 12:30? Okay, great. So you'll find at your seat.
a one-page document called Draft Measure Concepts for Inpatient Psychiatric Care. We have four measures that are in development that we just wanted you all to be aware of. These are not ready for us to include in the family of measures because they are still under development, but we wanted to just get feedback to pass forward to say, are these measures that the group supports the direction of? How might the measures be improved? So you have as much detail in the one-page handout that's in front of you. Again, in the setting of inpatient psych, the first one is suicide risk screening, second, violence risk screening, third one is alcohol and substance screening, and then finally metabolic screening. And it's just for you to kind of consider, and any input that you would like NQF map on behalf of the duals group to pass forward to CMS. This would be an opportunity for us to say we're wildly enthusiastic about these measures. Any feedback, how these measures might be improved, this would be your opportunity to weigh in. Again, it's the one-page handout here. Any thoughts, comments, anything for the good of the whole? Following the meeting, if you have comments, you could send them all to, you could send anything off to Sarah. Sarah would be happy to take comments, realizing this is just sprung on you. You might not have had much time to think about it.
I mean, I'll just say generally supportive, not knowing the specificity of the question, if we're comparing it to something else, but in all of these would seem to me to be important, and given some of the things we've just talked about, the metabolic screening would seem to be really important.
The only other comment I would make is that, and I was discussing this during the lunch break with Laura, I think one of my concerns here is that to better have impact on mental disease or any of the behavioral disorders, there's got to be coordination of care with primary care. Unfortunately, right now, the way we are, our current system is, there are barriers to that clear communication and ease of information flow. So when I'm looking at the metabolic screening, it would be nice to have this information or transmitted and provided to the primary care physician, because after all, the psychiatrists are not going to handle this kind of abnormalities that they may be seeing, and somebody needs to be on point to do that.
Thanks. Bruce.
I agree with that last comment, and also not only linkage, they need to have linkage to primary care, but I think you need to measure linkage to ongoing outpatient behavioral health care, which I don't see here. Because ideally, we would like to see inpatient admissions be reduced, and patients are getting better out in the community, and so I think that that's another key piece that needs to be added to this.
Thanks. Deb?
On the current IPS rules that released on the street?
On the current IPF rule that's on the street for comment right now, there's a measure of follow-up after post-discharge, 7 and 30 days, similar to the NCQA measure, that's mm-hmm. a post-hospital measure, but this measure is post-IPF discharge that holds the IPF accountable.
Thanks. Okie doke. Again, any thoughts you want to send on to Sarah, that'd be great. We'll go ahead and move into the next topic area. And the first couple slides in this area, Deb is going to present. So while you're getting ready to do that, I'll also just mention that we have two presenters who will come following Deb's presentation and conversation about measures, Chaz Mosley and Beth Mathis. Beth is from the Council on Quality and Leadership, and Chaz Mosley from the National Association of State Directors of Developmental Disability Services. So welcome. All right, Deb, take it away. We're all in sympathy.
So I'm going to sort of kick us off talking a little bit about Alzheimer's disease and related dementias and cognitive impairment. There's about 5 million persons who are estimated to have Alzheimer's disease and related dementia. As we all know, it's a non-curable disease. And as the disease advances, people with dementia eventually all need assistance with activities of daily living. It's the fifth leading cause of death among the population 65 and older. And as you know, the risk advances, the risk of getting Alzheimer's or related dementia advances with age. And so because of the aging of the population, the absolute numbers of people with Alzheimer's and related dementia, which henceforth I'll just say Alzheimer's, it will be increasing over time. So as a result of all of that, in 2011, there was a new piece of legislation enacted called the National Alzheimer's Project Act. Affectionately in government, you know, we like to give acronyms to everything, and so we call it the NAPA. Anyway, the major goals are listed there. Part of the concept was we, as a nation, need to organize ourselves and figure out how to come up with a cure for Alzheimer's and related dementia, because part of the system isn't quite set up for the number of people that are coming on board. But also because it is a terrible disease that puts a lot of strain on the family, obviously the person, the healthcare system. It's a disease that always results in death, the final outcome. So one of the goals of the plan was to improve early diagnosis and coordination of care and for the treatment of people with Alzheimer's. And so that's sort of where we all come on board. And as a result of this legislation, there was a national advisory council that advises the secretary that's made up of external stakeholders as well as people from the department. Next slide. So in 2012, the actual plan, the strategic plan, was released, and it's up on the department's website underneath the office of the secretary, which is the coordinating entity across the whole department. Just last week, I think, the statistics in the second bullet were released. looking at the rate of memory decline in the population 65 and older. This is a population-based measure out of the behavioral, the BRFIS, the Behavioral Health Risk Factor Surveillance System, so it's a self-reported measure. And as was pointed out here, that there are disparities in memory loss depending upon the subpopulations. These populations are at risk of poor outcomes, falls. They use hospitalizations, hospital services at a much higher rate than the Medicare population in general. I'll also mention that in our discussions today, I think it's important to remember the population that's in nursing homes. A lot of the things that we talk about don't include that population, but when we're talking about dementia and cognitive impairment, 60% of the nursing home population is cognitively impaired, and excluding them from discussion of the duals would be a something that I don't think we want to do. Among the duals population that's full eligible duals for the entire calendar year, about 1.1 of the duals use nursing homes in comparison to 1.2 million use home and community-based services. Then there's other settings, for example, assisted living where the rate is about 40% of the population. And then there's subpopulations, for example, that are high risk, such as the population with Down syndrome. And those numbers I cited are from a MACPAC report that was posted in March of this year. Next slide. So part of the plan that was developed actually calls for the development of high-quality dementia guidelines and quality of care measures. And specifically recommended that HHS develop measures and indicators for comprehensive care and treatment around persons with Alzheimer's disease. And among the topics that were recently recommended as key by the advisory panel are management of infections and antibiotic resistance, feeding and nutrition problems, falls and injury prevention, transitional care, hospitalizations, communication, and setting of goals. Next slide. There's a lot of difficulty in actually diagnosing dementia and determining it's different, that it has a lot of similarities in the actual diagnosis from depression and delirium. One of the big things recommended by the Alzheimer's plan was the screening of people for Alzheimer's and related dementias. The Affordable Care Act actually said, we're going to pay for this screening for the Medicare population 65 and older. And so as part of what's called the annual wellness visit, an annual screening for Alzheimer's and related dementia is now covered by Medicare. Not a lot of people know this, but, you know, that will change over time. But then there are issues around, well, how do you actually do the screening and what are the evidence-based tools? And so the Alzheimer's Association has recommendations on how to actually go about doing this, and NIA also has evidence-based recommendations. So there are guidelines available to go about doing this. There's also guidelines around some of the medications that have been developed for the treatment of Alzheimer's and related dementia, and they have various degrees of evidence that has changed over time. The population is also at higher rate of various adverse events. There was recently a journal article looking at the nursing home population with cognitive impairment and adverse events around the use of warfarin. There are lots of holes in the measurement system for this population. I actually have a list of them, but that's the file that wouldn't open up. It ranges all the way from treatment and diagnosis to providing care to family members, to assessing caregiver burden, to assessing the experience of the person, having the person articulate their goals, you know, where along the process that should be, and how along the process, as the dementia develops, the aims of care change. And if you don't do this screening regularly, you don't know about that, so you might not be providing the supports that are needed. One thing that would be helpful to the department, because there are so many holes and we do like to listen and hear what stakeholders say, is if you have suggestions for priorities for filling holes, you know, we would like to hear about it, because we do know that there are a lot of holes. There are a few measures that are used by CMS or physician measures. There's a couple of measures that have NQF endorsement. There's a measure that's used by Nursing Home Compare that looks at antipsychotic use among people who don't have a behavioral health diagnosis, i.e. using antipsychotics for behavioral issues. So I think I'll stop right there.
Thank you. We're going to have plenty more opportunity to discuss this, but we'll go ahead and finish just a few more little bits of update for you that we had since the web meeting. We wanted to make sure that folks were, when we started this conversation about the measures for the ID and DD populations, that we're talking about, you know, that we're using same definitions, common understanding. So here are the definitions for developmental disabilities and intellectual disability. I'll leave it up there in case this is a new distinction for you. Okay. Again, input that has that was in follow-up to the web meeting, that intellectual and developmental disabilities are related but different. And, you know, there is this lumping kind of tendency of people when you're going through things in a hurry. So just to be really clear, not all individuals with intellectual disability can be labeled as having a developmental disability and vice versa. And the impact of intellectual disability varies for each individual. And there's some statistics on that pie chart for you. The prevalence estimates are 4.7 million people living with an ID or DD condition and 1.2 million receiving DD services. And then this below comment, which that rings true from stuff I've heard too, that it's estimated that 40% of people with IDD are receiving services that from both Medicare and Medicaid. That statistic is familiar to me too. People with ID and DD have complex and challenging conditions, and this comes from the NCI Consumer Survey. You'll be hearing a little bit more about here after we go through some of the measures. So using the 2011-2012 data shows you the breakdown of various co-occurring conditions and specific conditions. Of note, that 53% take medications for mood disorders, anxiety, behavior problems, or psychotic disorders. Just checking. Okay. Additional related conditions, this comes from NHIS. And then just, you know, to put it in the perspective of why this subpopulation is important for us to consider for specific measures is that People with ID and DD are more at risk, more vulnerable than the general population of, among a variety of indicators, including abuse, crime, physical and sexual abuse, et cetera. And so there's some citations for you. And then the kind of to sum it all up, that between 60 and 100%, depending on the sample of individuals with DD, have experienced trauma and usually repeated incidents of abuse, a little bit older statistic, but still very sobering. So we have categories of measures that we're going to walk through first. We're going to follow that with the panel conversation about some of the big national efforts to gather information about quality of life, performance indicators, et cetera, for this population. But we're going to start with a handful of measures, and this will be a pretty rapid discussion. It's a small set, so we should. Our goal is to get through this part of the material in just a little over half an hour. So we'll move through pretty quickly, I think. We'll start with Sarah introducing the measure and talking about each one as we go. And again, similar to the last conversation, we're going to talk about whether these measures fit in this category that we're talking now. We've moved into the ID, DD, and people with dementia area. And so do these measures fit? So back to your big Excel table as Sarah walks through.
And you might have noticed, even from the names of the topics, that the measures we do have don't go far enough in this area for real person-centered care that addresses the vulnerabilities that we've just heard about. What we do have are a number of measures that are closer to IDDD and cognitive impairment populations than the SMI and SUD. So we're generalizing a little bit here. We'll be walking through functional status measures first. I think they apply to these populations as well as others. The first being measure 420, pain assessment and follow-up. This measure is in this group's core set. It does document an assessment and the follow-up taking place. Pain is really of specific importance for quality of life, and it, you know, leads to risks of abusing alcohol and other drugs if it's not well controlled. This measure is patient-reported, and it's in use in the Medicare Physician Feedback Program as well as PQRS. The second staff pick is NQF number 177, improvement in pain, interfering with activities. This was a group that a measure that was highlighted by this group for the medically complex older adults and the people with physical disabilities that were up for discussion at our last meeting. This is an outcome measure that also relates to function and quality of life. It's in MAPS safety family of measures. It's patient reported and promotes alignment with the Medicare Home Health Quality Reporting Program. So that's the downside as well. This is a narrowly scoped measure for use with people receiving home health services. The third staff pick under functional status is measure 430, change in daily activity function as measured by the AMPAC tool. This has been in our core measure set for some time. It's also patient reported. It's being used in the Blue Cross Blue Shield alternative contract in Massachusetts. And again, it's somewhat narrow to the post-acute care setting, which is why it's here in addition to the home health measure. The our functional status measure is not called out as staff picks that relate to ADLs in the nursing home population. A mobility assessment out of the AMPAC tool, and then a measure related to rehab for individuals who have a balance problem. So That's the high-level summary. Maggie, first comment?
I just feel like it needs to be said again, even though you just said it, Sarah. These are the absolute lowest level measures related to function and certainly quality of life. And I just feel it needs to be said, you know, again. No, I think that the staff picks are fine. If there was any move towards consolidation, I think you could probably drop the change in daily function. I mean, it's really so narrowly focused that it wouldn't apply to 99% of the people in this group, but I wonder if it's necessary.
Okay, thanks. Susan?
I was really struck by those statistics on abuse and all the violence. Are there no measures that are screening measures for sexual abuse or violence anywhere?
Some of those are in the survey instruments we'll hear about from our guest presenters, but out of the NCF portfolio, no.
So can that be a gap?
Alice, I'd like to postpone the discussion of activity measures, given what Maggie said, and we haven't heard the presentation, and I think we'll have more insight on this once we hear about two measurement systems that actually do this, and then we can come back to this.
Yeah, let's look and see if any of them. Well, Deb, go ahead first. You can talk about this. Microphone.
Sorry.
I really think that measure 688, which is a nursing home measure, should be included. It's derived from the NDS data, and it looks at the long stay residents, which are a very at risk population, and you know, I'd like to think for example that like managed long term care plans might look at something like this when they choose a nursing home to put their population in.
The percent of residents who lose too much weight, is that the one you're talking about?
Need for help with ADLs.
You need help with 12.4.
How did I lose that one?
So it's an error. The description is nursing home. MDS data is nursing home data. So it's really not ambulatory. It's really nursing home.
Thanks. Stephen?
I was interested about the possibility of the care for older adults measure that's a part of the HEDIS package. Was that considered? It has as one of four measures whether functional assessment had been recorded. Are any of those measures in the packet here? That
I think we have them categorized for the family discussion tomorrow. Because this was looking with an eye to the cognitively impaired aspects and the IDDD aspects. So general functional status measures, we might have not pulled all of them for this discussion. But we can make sure that we've done a thorough scrub of exactly what you're talking about and come back to that.
All right.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the Haas measure is a tough measure to use for collecting ADL data for two reasons. One, because it's a sample, and the people, there's a non-response bias related to it. The people that are, you know, the frailest and, you know, have the greatest needs are least likely to respond. And
plans that are serving duals have to report this MDS data anyway, and it's at the beneficiary level, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a more robust package, and some of our members have that are participating in the financial alignment demonstration have suggested that they, you know, they think that the MDS data are actually a better data set than HAAS for collecting functional data. So it's just a perspective.
Yeah, thank you.
Which is MDS, which is HAAS?
In this, this measure is referring to MDS data.
Which and one?
I'm sorry, 12.4.
Got it.
So to clarify, when you say HAAS, you're really talking about the health outcome survey that the plan does, and what you're saying is for a plan that includes the nursing home population, it might be more appropriate to actually look at the MDS data rather than look at survey data.
Right.
Okay, I got it.
Sorry, I didn't clarify that. Thank you.
Any in this group that people feel like you could support in any of the subpopulations we're talking about, ID, DD, cognitive impairment, before hearing any more about different sources of similar data? Not thrilled.
I mean, the principle of some kind of pain,
yeah,
screening, or I would think that we would be supportive of that. I have trouble parsing out between these two, which of the two is better, or, you know, I'm agnostic on that, but I think in principle there's enough evidence to say that that's really important.
Okay.
Are you talking about 12.1 and 12.2? But let's remember that we're excluding the cognitively impaired from 12.1. And
So duly noted as a, what I don't remember what we used to call those, but measure concepts, or, you know, I mean, so I think if this is the best pain measure we have, we take it, but we know it's got a weakness.
A lot of people have tried to deal with this issue, especially in measuring the nursing home population. How do you assess pain in the cognitively impaired? And there is research on this. It's not like we can't do it. It's just that the nursing home measures haven't moved into the ambulatory world.
Right. And I think that, you know, you could make the same questions in the ID and DD world of behaviors that you can't quite explain, but may have a basis, right, in poorly treated pain management. So,
Sarah and I are busy taking notes on this. That seems like an important thing to carry through into the report. Steve?
Both pain and function should be integral parts of the quality measures for people with cognitive impairment. So what tool we use to get at it, or we mention the fallacies of the specific measurement. But both of those should be as a very high priority.
All right, thanks. Do you want to move on to the to the BMI measure, Sarah?
Sure. We can do a little bit more sorting out of the pain area in follow-up to this meeting. What? I think that we
support for the concept and not really good examples of measures for these subpopulations is what I
heard. Although we might include 688 for the nursing home population, there's not a clear weakness to that one except that it's narrow.
everybody okay with that?
Yeah. Okay.
Consensus? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Please review that part of the draft deliverable carefully. So under nutrition, there are three available measures and one staff pick here. It's related to preventive care and screening around body mass index screening and follow-up. This measure is in the current core measure set, the MAPS cardiovascular disease and diabetes families. It's sensitive to known disparities in healthcare, and you know, nutrition and BMI was a key issue for all subgroups. In terms of alignment, this is in the Meaningful Use Program, the Shared Savings Program, Physician Feedback, Physician Quality Reporting System, the Massachusetts State Demonstration, and a handful of private programs as well. The measures not selected as staff picks under nutrition, one relates to dehydration. It's a PQI measure, so it's like a large population indicator. And the second is about the percentage of residents who lose too much weight as long stay. We've previously heard some doubts about the weight loss measure, not wanting to encourage use of feeding tubes and other mechanisms like that. And we would be open to any discussion about nutrition measures. Mm-hmm. Other people in previous meetings that we've been in have raised an unintended consequence of, you know, nutrition at the end of life that might not be in accordance with goals.
Laura?
I would definitely support the BMI measure. As a matter of fact, I was going to call it out as a gap under the preventive, but since you have it up here under nutrition, then that kind of covers it. So definitely, especially looking at the risk, the diabetes risk and the cardiovascular risk to this population, you're going to have to measure their BMI.
Thanks. Valerie, did you have your card up to speak? Okay. Maggie?
I also support the BMI measure.
All right. We'll keep that one in the family then, specific for this population, and move on to advanced illness care.
Under this category, we had three measures and two staff picks. The first is measure 326 for advanced care plan. This is in the current core set. It's in MAPS care coordination and hospice families of measures. It's sensitive to known healthcare disparities. It is looking at adults 65 and older, so that's something to keep in mind as potential weakness in the measure. But it is in use in the Medicare physician feedback and physician quality reporting systems, and this is reported by special needs plans that serve older adults. The second measure in this category is number 1626, patients admitted to the ICU who have their care preferences documented. I think we saw this for the first time at our most recent previous meeting. It's in the core set that we currently have. The attributes of the measure are very important to patients and consumers, the documenting care preferences or a clear reason why those weren't able to be captured. And this group had previously suggested that it could be expanded beyond the ICU setting, but it is an important point to look at serious illness care.
Joan.
If I recall from our earlier conversations, or maybe it was just other conversations at a different place, that the issue of advanced care planning should not be specific to people over 65 or people in ICU or people in hospice and palliative care. I think that for all the populations that we're dealing with of dual eligible beneficiaries, as well as all of us, we should be doing advanced care planning. And I think it's particularly important when people are reliant on family caregivers, that both sides of the equation have plans. So I think we need to really highlight that again.
I'd take it one step further, and I'd say, you really need to have that in every setting of care for someone who has cognitive impairment, especially if the person is in the hospital.
Maggie.
Yeah, actually, I agree. I think it's an important part of the health care plan for everyone, and it's noticeably absent here for this population. And I also want to agree with Deb as well as Jim. So it's a mutual love fest here. yeah.
There was a great, I just have to insert a little parenthetical remark. There was a great TED Med talk about this guy who happens to be in my backyard at the University of Washington starting this grassroots initiative, Dinner Conversations About Death. And it all started, he's a communications guy, you know, he's not a medical person, but it started because he was on a train with these two docs and they were all talking about what the huge gap and where people want to be when they're dying compared to where they die is, and how much bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy, is related to the over expenditure on medical care at the end of life. And it's like, sign me up, you know. I'm like, I've already got all my neighbors. Like, as soon as he rolls this out, which is going to be sometime this summer, we are going to have a dinner conversation over death in Olympia, Washington. You're all invited. So love fest on these two measures. They're in the core set. Any questions or comments, Clark?
I just want to make sure our discussion includes the point this morning on psychiatric advance directives, because it's frequently ignored, and we do have state laws, and we do have a SAMHSA framework for psychiatric advance directives.
All right, so support for keeping these in and specific to these subpopulations, and now we'll move to acquired cognitive impairment.
Okay, we have about five measures in this area, three that have been highlighted by staff. The first, measure 2111, antipsychotic use in persons with dementia. This is, I think, newly endorsed. It hasn't come before you before. We think that it'll help address the inappropriate over-medication of individuals with dementia. It's specified for the health plan level of analysis, and it is currently specific to people over 65. Measures number 2091 and 2092 have to do with a person having persistent indicators of dementia but not actually having the diagnosis for both long-stay and short-stay patients within skilled nursing facilities. These are almost structural measures that quantify the number of residents in a facility that have these indicators without the diagnosis, and it can be collected through an electronic medical record. There's two measures not picked by staff in this category. They're very narrow, related to stroke, ordering rehab services, and screening for dysphagia.
Okie doke. Anybody want to weigh in a supportive way on any of these? Sean?
The antipsychotic medication and dementia is really important. It's a big issue.
I'm sorry to be the devil in the details here. This measure, the one that we're discussing, includes bipolar disorder. However, the measure that CMS uses on nursing home compare excludes bipolar disorder.
Susan?
This is one of the points I was going to raise, but it's good, but I do want to speak in favor of this, and we are going to put this type of measure into our scorecard, long-term services and support state scorecard. And there are interventions, major policy interventions going on to address this. Yeah, I think you're right.
Joan?
I guess it's just sort of a comment of frustration, perhaps. But, you know, sort of a measure of persistent indicators of dementia without a diagnosis for someone who's a long stay in a nursing home, like, does that matter? I mean, what is that? So you have this diagnosis. If you really look at person-centered care, it's about what the person's needs are, and it's not really reflecting care. Like, it should, I mean, if we're paying attention to the conversation that's going on about the DSM-5, part of the issue is not structuring things around diagnosis, but really looking at what people's needs are. And so it just doesn't seem highly important if we're trying to be parsimonious about measures, unless I'm kind of missing something. Deb will help me.
I agree. That's exactly where we should be, but I don't think we're quite there yet. And to me, what this is saying is, the MDF, which is uniformly collected on everybody in a nursing home, if it has multiple indications that you might have dementia and you don't have a diagnosis of dementia, perhaps the medical delivery system in the nursing home might not be what it should be. Well, I know you and I know that, and most of the people in this room know that, but so for that reason, I don't want to get rid of it, you know, especially when you consider the people who transition from the hospital to the nursing home who might have delirium and all of those kinds of issues. I really want them to pay attention to it and possibly do a screening. But, you know, I agree that if the person has cognitive issues, you need to provide the supports, and that's what should be done. But perhaps we need to figure out why they have the cognitive impairment. But I don't know, maybe I'm crossing hairs, but it's not a burdensome measure, and it's collected with a decent data set. So in that respect, it's a way for a plan to help pick a nursing home.
Yeah.
Leonardo.
I think I'm going down the same line, Joan, is. I just, this might be an area where, you know, in many of the areas, we recognize that there are some problems with the measure, and it's going to need some tweaking. This is an area where I don't quite see any of these as even being the first step, because they're either extremely narrow, like the antipsychotic is a great one, but it seems extremely narrow to me. Obviously, screening is important, so a screening measure, great. I'm a big fan of screening measures, so I'm always sort of for a screening measure. But the treatment side of it, it seems like, you know, I'm imagining the clients that I've worked with, and there's nothing here that gets in any sort of comprehensive way as something that's going to improve their lives. So I think this is one where it's not just a little tweaking that needs to happen, like we need to apply it across another setting. I think there needs to be a sort of go back to the drawing board and say, what are the really important things that someone with a dementia diagnosis needs? What's the optimal care for that person like? And let's design a measure around that.
It's a measure around the aspect of care, and not a measure around
right.
The care.
Right.
I mean, that's the overall issue, is so they have MDS 2.0. It's a screening tool. Then it triggers assessments. And after those assessments, maybe there's the care that goes with them. So,
go ahead.
Care,
right?
It's also all kinds of things
that complete.
Oh, sorry.
I'm blocked. Okay, there we go. It's also not just, you know, making sure the care is provided, but I think you would have a lot of things about, you know, making sure that just because somebody has the diagnosis, they're not falling into a reduced level of autonomy that is the standard package that everybody with the diagnosis gets. And, you know, so I think there are a lot of things that are weighing in here that would be missing.
Maggie.
Yeah, I would like to echo what everyone else has said, but I think that a screening for dementia is not a bad thing. I think a screening for antipsychotic overuse is not a bad thing. I question why they need to be the same screening. I think these are different issues. And I think particularly when we're talking about a population with intellectual disability, we're talking much more sensitive tools than just the general tool.
Steve.
Yeah, I don't think 15.4 and 15.5 may not rise to the level, with the measure burden and such, but I couldn't help but at least comment that this may, if these factors are met, this harkens back to the whole assessment, what happened in the assessment process, what happened in the care, if they don't have something diagnosed or documented in their chart of being demented, that certainly has care implications either way. Whether if they're demented, they should have a different care plan and maybe be on different medications and such. So I think these are clear potential indicators of, but whether they rise to the to the level of our 60 package family, that's another case relative to other measures.
Valerie?
Yeah, I don't have input from any of my members on this one, so I think that both of the measures are important, and I thought one of the things that Deb was suggesting is that you not only needed to screen to see if they do have dementia so you can have an appropriate plan of care, but to make sure that they don't have dementia, because especially for the older cognitively impaired people that are going into the hospitals and then coming back to nursing homes, their drugs are all changed around. And many times they're diagnosed with dementia when it really isn't dementia. It's a drug-related issue that happened when they were in the hospital. And we need to know that. I've heard family stories about people whose parent came back from the hospital to assisted living and said, your dad's got Alzheimer's. You better find a special care unit for him. And, within a month he was fine again because the assisted living got his meds under, this was a unbelievable assisted living. It probably should have been a nursing home. But, those are scary things. And I think they need to be addressed. And I don't know what screening for dementia that they had in mind here. But.
To take these kind of one at a time, we've had really different opinions expressed. So the first one, the antipsychotic use in persons with dementia, we know it's a really important federal issue. It's really important for the whole, are people being inappropriately restrained chemically in institutional settings? You think it's a better measure than the one that's in nursing home compare? But we also hear some reservations about it. So let me just see, is there a consensus around including this one?
We're looking at 15.3.
We're looking at 15.3 antipsychotic use. Yeah? Good enough. Okay. All right. We'll keep that one in. And then the next two we'll take together, the persistent indicators of dementia without a diagnosis, long stay and short stay. So again, there's data ready to hand. Seems like it might be an important measure, but we're not exactly sure what we're measuring. Steve?
Just wanted to clarify maybe one of the points. This is not really screening in terms of for cognitive impairment. This is, if you're looking at the denominator statements, these are people who have had a mental status assessment and failed it miserably, but it hasn't been recognized. Or at least documented in the charts in some way. So that, just to clarify what we're, considering here, it does, as reading further through the denominator statement, if you've got somebody with those issues going on in their MDS, but you haven't documented something in the chart to relate to that, that, does get at, I think, the kind of things we're very interested in. We want people to be assessed and we want to identify cognitive impairment when it's present or when it's not, or at least explain why it is, whether it's delirium or dementia, both of which are highly unrecognized and confused with each other.
Gwen.
So I just want to echo what Steve was saying and
the intent, I think, behind this measure was, as I was participating in the group that formed this measure, was that when people are screened with the MDS, that's done by the nursing home staff and often not communicated to the physician. So if they're failing these tests and should be assessed by the physician, but the physician's not being told, which is what's happening, then we're not recognizing the problems. And it also harkens back to the last measure we were just speaking about, because that measure is specifically only for people with a diagnosis of dementia. And the feeling is that dementia is not diagnosed as much as it is prevalent in the nursing home by a whole bunch. And so people are being put on antipsychotics who don't have a diagnosis of dementia on the chart, but they really do have dementia, so they should be included in the previous measure.
Joan?
I guess I can't be here tomorrow, so I have to try to act out as much as I can today. I think this is a major issue, but the screening tool is not going to resolve the problem of people doing the MDS and then the medical person not knowing what the MDS says. That's a different problem, and we're not resolving it here. And I'm really concerned that as we come up with our measures, if we focus just on screening, which is what we've been pretty much focusing on all of today, we won't have like measures left to actually look at transitions of care and look at some of the actual outcomes. And so, yes, it's important, but it's just like sort of an example of a whole bunch of things. So people do the MDS and they have all these psychosocial needs, but nobody meets them in nursing homes. It's well documented. There's staffing issues, which are sort of on our list of things. I mean, it's a whole set of things, and I just feel like this is sort of kind of a good example of a major problem, and I think we sort of miss the problem if we kind of say, oh, okay, this will help.
So, so of course now tomorrow, if we get to the end of the day and we have, you know, 70 or 100 measures and we want to scale back, we can always do that. I don't get like a two-thirds, one-third kind of opinion feeling from you guys. It feels like there's some support. So let's do a show of hands on this.
Alex, can I chime in with one quick comment?
Yes, you may. Who's talking? Hello.
I think there may be like the difference between something that is a necessary condition and a sufficient condition. And I think, you know, the point made by Gwen is obviously a really good one, that if the screening is done and it doesn't get to the other points in the system that are interacting with this person, you're not going to get a systemic solution to the problem the person has. So it's a necessary step, but I think what I have seen, and I think what Joan is going towards, is there is a very persistent systemic problem with plenty of people who are identified and their preferences don't exist anymore, their treatment plans don't really make them safe. I mean, there's a big safety issue here. So I think that I'm not opposed to these measures. I'm just opposed to the notion that these measures are addressing the cognitive impairment problem we have.
Okay. Gotcha. Sean?
Since we brought up psychosocial measures, you know, looking at the MDS, why not throw in a measure for Section Q? You know, I mean, you want to leave the nursing home, you want to get out in the community. That's a huge one for all the quality of life stuff and all the things. And then also I'll throw a plug in for PASAR, pre-admission screening and resident review. That's supposed to be done in every state for IDD forever, right, and for mental health. And it's done, it's not done, it's sort of messy. There's a whole thing on on specialized treatment in there that's supposed to be delivered, wherever the person is, in the nursing home, or documented what needs to be done in the community. So this is a plug.
So Sarah's going to do a whole little paragraph on this in the technical report and how this is, like, necessary but not sufficient, and then I think those are really helpful points that maybe that's not even the most important thing that's being collected by MDS. There's a whole range of things that we could be considering. So now there are people feeling okay about including with all these caveats? Yes. Okay. All right. Moving on to now we're going to get now we'll hear more about the. I think our break isn't until 2:30. Sorry.
Break from the table.
yeah, you can take a break from the like Excel spreadsheet, right?
I thought where you were headed was, given all those caveats, it didn't seem like the best measure to include. I thought that's where this was going.
Okay, then we do need a vote. Include. The question is, with all the caveats, should we include the two measures, 2091 and 2092? Show of hands, please. Include the measures. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Hand up if you say exclude. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Well, okay, we're including, and then we'll come back around tomorrow. If it seems like we have 100 measures, we'll come back and have the conversation again tomorrow. So, Chaz and Beth, thank you so much for being here. You can tell how much we need input from people with other measures and solutions, and we're really excited that you're here to present. So take it away.
Developmental Disability Services, is that better? And Mary Lee Faye, who's in the back of the room, is with the same organization, and Mary Lee is our new director of National Core Indicators, and we'll be following up with any of you if you have any questions about any of these materials. There's more slides than I can possibly make it through in the time available, so I'm going to be highlighting the key points on each one, but I wanted to give you the information so that if you wanted to look back, you'd have a kind of a broader understanding of what the core indicators are and the kinds of factors, variables that they assess and how they're being used. It was launched in 1997 with 13 participating states currently, with a contract with the Administration on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. We're expanding the number of participating states from about 25 a couple of years ago to all 50 plus the District of Columbia over the next 3 years. We have a 14-year database on the performance of state developmental disabilities agency systems that is really unparalleled and doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, as we've talked to our other counterparts in other countries. It's about moving from about 12,000 individuals each year. It'll be jumping up to a little over 20,000 over the next couple of years. In fact, when California came into the survey system 2 years ago, the numbers of people about doubled. It's supported by participating states, and it's operated as a collaborative between the National Association, the Human Services Research Institute, and the participating state DD agencies. A quick shot of the map. You can see just about everybody is engaged, and they will be. We have 5 more states that will be coming on after the 1st of July. The purpose was really to meet the need of state developmental disabilities agencies, administrators, and policymakers for data. As some of you know, services, long-term supports to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities are provided almost exclusively by states. There's not a private market for that. Some states are experimenting with managed care, and a couple have independent for-profit. Wisconsin jumps to mind, managed care MCOs in a couple of areas, but by and large, even the managed care is operated by state agencies. States really wanted some data documenting the effect of services on the day-to-day lives of people who receive them. document the experience of program participants, how they believe services and supports impact their lives, track performance goals, and be able to respond to the needs of consumers and families for information on what services are actually providing. Long-term supports for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities represent a pretty significant investment that states makes and the public really makes in the lives of these people, and so it makes sense to make sure that those investments are going in the right direction. NPI is designed to measure system performance, looking at the extent to which key outcome variables in the system are being achieved over time, and also in comparison with other states and other state agencies. And they're focusing on person-centered objectives around employment, choice, health,